I'll switch to English now because João Dionísio from Portugal unfortunately doesn't speak German, but many other languages. So we agreed on German, and this is sort of my darkest hour, because my Portuguese is not only bad, it's non-existent. So when I read this text, you know, just pluck your ears, it's for the others, you know. So I will introduce you very shortly. João Dionísio is associate professor at the Faculdade de Letras, Universidade de Lisboa. See, there it goes. Between 2010 and 2013, he directed the program in textual criticism. He has been a member of Centro de Linguistica, it's more Italian what I'm doing, da Universidade de Lisboa, belonging to the philology group. For a long time, he has focused his research on textual scholarship. He has worked on the electronic edition of Leal Conselheiro, you do that in a minute, a medieval Portuguese canonical work. He has prepared three volumes of Fernando Pessoa's critical edition series in 1993, 97, and 2004. And he has coordinated the inventory of MS Lorenzo's papers, kept in the National Library of Portugal. He is currently the president of the European Society for Textual Scholarship. And today he will present a keynote with the title International or Global Networking Against the Backdrop of Non-Digital and Digital Editorial Ventures. The floor is yours.
Okay, four lines in German. Guten Abend. Ich möchte mich sehr herzlich bedanken dafür, dass ich eingeladen bin, hierher zu kommen und mit Ihnen über Textkritik diskutieren zu können. Leider kann ich kein Deutsch und deshalb muss ich von jetzt an meinen Vortrag auf Englisch halten. Ich bitte um Verzeihung. I would like to start out by saying that I'm very honored by the invitation to speak about editorial scholarship in the Herzog August Bibliothek Wolfenbüttel at the MVV conference Digitale Metamorphose, Digital Humanities and Editionswissenschaft. I would like to express my gratitude to Dr. Thomas Sticker for having me, and of course to Roland Kanzelak for the friendly introduction. Allow me also to say that it is a privilege to meet again my colleague Bodo Plachta on this occasion. The title of this conference indicates that a transformation in academic cooperation in the field of textual scholarship has occurred or is in the process of occurring as a consequence of the ways we explore the digital medium. It is always difficult to speak detachedly about a phenomenon that is ongoing, fluid, multifaceted, and complex in its several aspects. Transformation, especially in the guise of metamorphosis and biological metamorphosis as represented by the conference poster, indicates that the changes in academic cooperation have more to do with an alteration in nature than with an alteration in degree. However, by adopting a global and historical point of view, I would like to argue that while some of the most visible changes are gradual, or at least they seem gradual to me, it remains to be seen whether a few very important ones might be differences in nature. At the basis of networking lies cooperation, and since textual scholarship deals mostly with written documents, it could be argued that the minimal scholarly act and the backbone of editing activities is reading. Against essentialist views of such an act, the act of reading, understanding reading as an instance of collaboration may be seen as a mode of academic cooperation. And notwithstanding differences in their approaches, authors like Wolfgang Iser, Stanley Fish, and Jerome Again, among others, have contributed to the general acceptance of this standpoint. Wolfgang Iser claimed that the transference of text to reader, rather than being put into practice singly by the textual entity, occurs only if the reader's faculties of perceiving and processing are activated. It is because the text does not fully control this process that there is a creative side to reading. Another name for this creative side is, of course, cooperation. When more than one scholar engages with a text or a set of texts in complementary or in competitive manner, and regardless of how many people are involved in such activities, an interpretive community emerges. Roughly by the same time, Stanley Fish argued that text is not a self-sufficient repository of meaning because meaning is produced in a dynamic relation with the reader's expectations, projections, conclusions, judgments, and assumptions. It is neither located in the text, nor is it the reader's job to extract it from the text. As a consequence, the identification of formal units in interpretation is not due to their presence in the text, but are a function of the interpretive model one brings to bear. The standpoint both Iser and Fish adopt reappear in general terms in the field of textual scholarship, for instance, in Jerome Again's The Textual Condition, namely in the chapter How to Read a Book. McGann's own viewpoint is clear constructivist and against the once traditional perception of textual scholarship as an activity that guaranteed the stability of texts and the taming of meaning. The recent past and the present in this field of knowledge have not ceased to acknowledge the importance of interpretive communities in the construction of meaning. For a considerable period of time, the one language and literature model has played a dominant role as an identification marker of many of these interpretive communities. The blurred frontiers of the research objects these communities worked on have contributed to their expansion, but have also given occasion to the appearance of alternative models. As Jupp Leersen points out, some ambiguities stand out in the Lang-Litt model when one thinks of Milton writing in Latin and English, or Nabokov in Russian and English, or when one thinks of the tradition of medieval Latin and Neo-Latin texts, or the cases of authors from bilingual countries rooted in more than one linguistic tradition, and so forth. In any event, the Lang-Litt model may well serve as an example of modalities of scholarly cooperation at an international level before the digital medium established itself. I will concentrate on the Romance languages and literature subset and illustrate very briefly the three aspects of scholarly editing that I will take into consideration later on. And these three facets, and I will approach them very, very briefly, are archival institutions and libraries, philological networks, and publishing houses. In our day and age, we take for granted that European libraries and archives take interest in acquiring, and most importantly, in making available, bibliographic items and documents whose cultural meaning is not parochially national. There are, of course, exceptions to this rule, but it will suffice to illustrate this point with reference to the fact that one of the most crucial manuscripts of the Chanson de Roland, a touchstone in the history of French literature and nation building, is kept at the Bodleian Library in Oxford. Or to the fact that one of the very few handwritten songbooks witnessing the Galician Portuguese troubadour poetry is preserved at the Vatican Library. A good example of scholarly cooperation at an international level in respect of manuscript search has to do with this codex. against the backdrop of Romance philology and of the raiding for manuscripts of unknown whereabouts, the Austrian philologist Ferdinand Wolff thought that the most effective way to search for a specific songbook of Portuguese medieval poems, whose copy had been ordered by the Italian humanist Angelo Colocci, was to look for traces of it in the Vatican library. The person Wolff asked to undertake this task was the Slavist Jernej Bartolomeusz Kopitar, who proceeded accordingly, but with no success. Later on, the very same Ferdinand Wolff asked the Franciscan Portuguese priest, Ruquet, who eventually managed to have it found. The result is what is now known as the Vatican Codex 4803, which transmits more than 1,000 medieval poems, being a priceless document of troubadour poetry in the Iberian Peninsula between the beginning of the 12th and mid-14th century. It should be noted, in all fairness, that these were the times when German philologists animated the development of editorial initiatives in other countries, both in Europe and beyond. Although we spoke of Émile Renoir as Gründer der Romanischen Philologie, it is Friedrich Dietz who is more consensually viewed as a founder of Romance philology. German philologists from the Grimm School exerted a strong influence on Provençal and Spanish medieval philological studies. And comparatively to the mandatory trip to Italy for anyone wishing to become a professional in the fine arts, the would-be philologist was expected to travel to Germany. Gaston Paris and later on Joseph Bidier made such journeys. And when this did not happen, it was Germany that moved across its own borders. One of the first landmarks in the description of Romance languages and literatures was the Grundriss der Romanischen Philologie, organized by Gustav Gröber. The history of Portuguese literature, attributed to the German Carolina Michaelis Vasconcelos, Vasconcelos being the surname of the historian of art she was married to. Again, the history of Portuguese literature attributed to the German Carolina Michaelis Vasconcelos and Teófilo Braga was included in the volume 2 of the Grundriss, part 1, issued in 1897. As a matter of fact, this history of Portuguese literature was originally supposed to be designed and written only by Braga and translated into German by Carolina Michaelis. In the end, though, the first and longer part of the history was written by Michaelis, based on Braga's text, and only the second, much shorter, and I mean really much shorter part, was ascribed to the Portuguese intellectual. A passage of a letter Carolina Michaelis wrote to Braga on the subject, and Braga was not very comfortable with the credits of the first part, this passage showcases what Germany could mean in certain quarters. Okay, so this is Carolina Michaelis writing to Braga. "You, sir, had put your article entirely at my disposal. You have even asked me to translate it freely, Germanizing it somewhat. That is, adding dates and bibliographic notes, which it much needed. Making it more precise, developing it, and even modifying what seemingly called for correction, etc., etc. It is the fault of your courtesy if I have come to see myself as your collaborator rather than your translator." End of quote. Apart from scholarly journals, such as Romania, or Zeitschrift für Romanische Philologie, accepting the articles in different languages, there were also publishing houses, Max Niemeyer being one of them, that also published philological works in diverse European languages. Well, when it came to Romance philology and taking into account its strong international framework, Gaston Paris aimed to place it, philology that is, within a system of fields of knowledge he called the Cité des Sciences, the City of Sciences. This would be a more or less utopian space with no geopolitical borders, inhabited by scholars, fully oriented, as Ursula Beller says, to pursue truth as an unnational value. The utopian impulse underpinning such a city of sciences, a close relative of the Republic of Letters, echoes intensely at the opening session of the 1928 International Congress of Mathematicians held at Bologna. It was then that David Hilbert allegedly produced a statement of considerable political and scholarly import, and I quote, "It makes me very happy that after a long, hard time," and he was alluding to the First World War, "all the mathematicians of the world are represented here. It is a complete misunderstanding of our science to construct differences according to peoples and races. The whole cultural world is a single country." And I end quote. Even if some doubts remain as to Hilbert's exact words, it seems useful to take this quotation into account when reflecting upon the dreamlike pursuit of a common ground in methodological, terminological, and theoretical terms within the field of scholarly editing. A sign of such desideratum ground can perhaps be found in the supposedly Lachmanian ideal of establishing a text as the result of a systematological inquiry conducted without having recourse to personal judgment. And I would like to stress the adverb supposedly. Still, the famous quotation reads, "Recensere sine interpretatione possumus et debemus," even if the quotation was nothing more than empty boasting on the part of Lachmann, as Timpanaro suggests. Another sign might be found in an extraordinary speculation by the scholar who created copytext editing, Gregg, who in the article Bibliography and Apologia said that it would be interesting to edit a text with no meaning. And this consideration was the result of the following premise, and I quote, "The study of textual transmission involves no knowledge of the sense of a document, but only of its form. The document may theoretically be devoid of meaning, or the critic ignorant of its language." End of quote. Editorial scholarship would thus triumphantly tower in a highly formalized and shared way over textual dimensions one could do without: language, meaning. At a time when the professionalization of editorial scholarship was beginning, Hausmann would voice a strong individualistic standpoint against common ground. One could not become a professional textual critic. Either you were born one or no deal. Criticus nascitur, non fit. Unsurprisingly, Hausmann did not hold those aspects of textual scholarship which would meet a strong cooperative development over the 20th century. He did not hold them in high esteem. And I mean hard manuscript work, collation, and the much abhorred history of the transmission of texts, what the Germans called Überlieferungsgeschichte. However, apart from isolated and highbrow positions such as Hausmann's, one finds conflicting perspectives with respect to the pair one goal, one method approach in other quarters. Actually, another goal of Romance philology was to reconstruct, through the study of languages and literatures, the development of different national awarenesses. And as Peter Schillingsburg has recently argued, different editorial goals are desirable under different cultural and economic and intellectual conditions, and different goals must be met by different methods. Or, a variant of this, in Paul Egger's phrasing, the first rule of thumb is in editing is that every editing situation is different, and therefore no rule will be universally applicable. The tension between global aims and methods on the one side and local goals and procedures on the other have not disappeared with the growing presence of digital editing. But before exploring some facets of this tension, it seems pertinent to say that similarly to what happened with the transition from oral to written culture, this change is not a replacement as far as pre-digital and digital editorial scholarship are concerned. Allow me to see this. Okay. Elena Pierazzo is right when commenting on a contribution by two other colleagues, says that the new medium does not supersede the old one. Like the wireless did not replace the concert hall and the television did not replace the cinema, but joins the old medium in an often positive and invigorating interaction. In any event, an idea of replacement is somehow hinted at by the poster of this conference, in which the butterfly life cycle is reduced to two stages, the larva, or caterpillar, and the adult butterfly, thus suggesting a symmetrical relationship with a pre-digital editorial stage and a digital editorial stage. Central to the development of the butterfly is the marvelous process of molting. Since the skin of the caterpillars cannot expand with them, they grow another larger skin, which throws out the outward skin. This process repeating itself until, after molting for the fifth time, the new skin gains the form of the outer shell of the chrysalis. In the end, inside the chrysalis or pupa, the caterpillar undergoes the transformation into an adult butterfly. In a similar way, digital editing is given the possibility of dealing with significantly larger textual scholarly capacity than book format editorial ventures. Due to the constraints of printing, publication, and distribution, editors were often forced to present only the final version as an edited text and to exclude information from apparatuses. But the digital overcoming of these technological constraints has allowed for seemingly all-inclusive editorial goals. Storage is then a major strength among the possibilities opened up by digital philology, side by side with others that are related to, and I enumerate them, the stages of collation, stemma extraction, analysis, annotation, and edition proper, besides some research in the field of automated transcription. Sharing and making available tools and programs in these different editorial stages and fields have been enhanced by several digital, international, and collaborative platforms. Okay, this was the other quotation, I'm sorry. And I will name just a few of them. InterEdition, the European-funded cost action and supranational infrastructure, aiming and promoting, and I quote, the interoperability of the tools and methodology in the field of digital scholarly editing and research. TextCrit, the project funded by the German Federal Ministry of Education and Research until very recently, and seeking to address the needs of virtual research environment in the humanities. The digital research infrastructure, DARIA, which is also supported by the Federal Ministry of Education and now hosts TextGrid administration and repository technologies. This is widely known, of course. The Australian Electronic Scholarly Editing Project, which intends to develop a set of interoperable services to support the production of electronic scholarly editions by distributed collaborators in a Web 2.0 environment. And even if specifically Australian in the name, it results from collaboration between Australian universities, Loyola University in Chicago and University of Saskatchewan, which means Paul Eggert, Peter Schillingsburg, Peter Robinson. In a growingly flattened world in which geographic borders tend to fade, the expanding number of easily accessible digital archives, programs and tools stimulates a modicum of standardization. To a certain extent, this perception regarding editorial scholarship echoes what Erich Auerbach stated about world literature in mid-20th century. The present conception of world literature, he said, accepts as an inevitable fact that world culture is being standardized. Notwithstanding the merits of shareable goats and modus operandi in editorial activities, a crucial dimension of editing and translating has to do with acknowledging and representing difference. The functional connection between standardization and interoperability is thus an important issue, but I won't go over it since it has just been approached by Bodo Plachter. It is largely through networking projects, such as the ones I mentioned, that a butterfly-like shortcoming of digital editorial initiatives that has been identified by some scholars. The life of butterflies usually spans between a week and a month. Taking into consideration only the developed countries, Pierre-Marc Biasi writes that since 1990, and he was writing this around 2010-11, Pierre-Marc Biasi writes that since 1990, each one of us has changed at least 5 or 6 times his or her personal computer. That is, every 3 or 4 years in order to stay technically updated. But who of us, he asks, has kept the former 6 computers and their hard disks? Almost no one. As a consequence, almost all electronic genetic documents of the past 20 years are utterly lost. Then the Biasi concludes dramatically that there won't be archives of all modernity between 1990 and 2010. For the first time after 2 centuries, we have before us a black hole in our cultural memory with no precedent, but in the darkest periods of our history. More, this black hole is bound to expand. In a complementary standpoint, Daniel O'Donnell found that most of the editions on CD-ROMs he examined could not be used shortly after their publication. The obsolescence of web publication is also visible. Easy to put online, easy to take down, Pierazzo says. So here is a list made by Joris van Zundert and Peter Gut of what can go wrong. Temporary or permanent unavailability of resources and services. Services either down or discontinued. Hosting institutions that are closed down or that are affected by new objectives and priorities. Upgrades to baseline services such as authentication and non-baseline services such as annotation linking services. Upgrades to platforms and code libraries. The list could go on. In order to live up to the growing technological and organizational burden associated with the preservation of digital editions and thus enable them to live a longer and more stable life than that of flickering butterflies, van Zundert and Gut communicated their vision of future libraries. In their vision, the library, and the archive I imagine, apart from being in a position to transform resources into services, would not only preserve digital editions, but also give access to their proteiform nature. It is the libraries that are able to define, manage and maintain the processes, workflows and quality controls that can assure the edition's long-term availability in the digital realm. Among the many challenges this vision faces stands a reconfigured notion of legal deposit. The legal deposit is often said to ensure that the published output is collected systematically to preserve the material for the use of future generations, as stated on the British Library webpage. If the published output is to be systematically collected, and I quote from a recent call for contributions on computer-aided processing of intertextuality in ancient languages, what is one to do with information overload of digitally available data resulting from mass digitization? Issues such as these came from being seen against the backdrop of regional and global policies. In the European Union funding program Horizon 2020, the humanities and human sciences were not considered at first. And as Domenico Fiormonte states, it was a successful petition signed by thousands of professionals working in the cultural heritage sector, including museums, galleries, and others, that made the European Parliament explicitly add the label cultural heritage in the funding program. In respect of cultural heritage, UNESCO and other organizations have been actively promoting the preservation of world heritage sites and artifacts. Underlying the classification of these sites and artifacts, as well as the production of guidelines regarding conservation or restoration, is a political principle of international understanding at large. It may serve as an example of this principle, a passage from the preamble of the Recommendation on International Principles Applicable to Archaeological Excavations, issued in New Delhi in 1956. There one reads that the feelings aroused by the contemplation and study of works of the past do much to foster mutual understanding between nations, and that it is therefore highly desirable to secure international cooperation with regard to them and to further, in every possible way, the fulfillment of their social mission. In this respect, given the volatility of political regimes in Africa and the cultural consequences often arising from such volatility, reference should be made, even if in a restricted linguistic sense, to the action of one of the international teams working at the Institut des Textes et des Manuscrits Modernes, TITEM. The manuscript francophone team, supported by the French National Funding Agency and European Programme Discovery, pursues the goal of producing a reference edition of francophone literary texts of special relevance, which are to be published in the Planète Libre series. And the name of the series is obviously a political statement, as well as saving from oblivion and destruction francophone literary documents. The latter goal is to be reached through the creation of a digital archive, but also a physical library to keep the manuscripts. If this case may serve as an example of complex inclusivity, testifying to international cooperation, even if still attached to an offspring of the Langlet model, an additional note should be given on the subject of inclusiveness and digital scholarship. Fiormonte points out that the Alliance of Digital Humanities Organizations embodies an over-representation of Anglophone institutions. The ADHO, such is the acronym, is said to work actively toward the creation of a more diverse, welcoming, and inclusive global community of digital humanities scholars and practitioners. But it is now not clear how ADHO could foster diversity while keeping a governance structure largely dominated by the founders, and the founders are US, Canada, Australian, Japanese, and European associations or institutions. And the founders have the prerogative to decide who can become a member and the procedure for applying. In our part of the world, the digital medium has facilitated the creation of new interpretive communities and has strengthened already existing ones, even if no longer in a central position in Western education system, or even if these communities are endangered. The actual or potential disappearance of Greek and Latin from the secondary school curriculum in several European countries has been successfully counterattacked by the acknowledgement of multi-communities across the world interested in developing classical studies. But still, apart from our world, there is another one. This is now widely known. A widely known photo by John Stanmeyer, the World Press Photo winner of 2014. Some African migrants in the city of Djibouti raised their phones trying to catch a signal from Somalia. In the developed countries, it is taken for granted that citizenship is served by the digital medium. Because this is true, as long as populations of different regions of the world do not have access to digital tools, we Westerners gain from being aware that ours is a position of privilege and that the world global deserves an Orwellian comment. The digital metamorphosis is a global transformation, but much more global in some places than in others. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much, João. This was a wonderful talk. I think you put a clasp around this whole conference by moving from the tradition using the participatory term to disseminate knowledge globally with means of digital, with the chances that lie in that, up to the very important issue that institutions like ours confront every day, which is digital preservation. So you have the whole stretch of it. Thank you very much for it. Are there any questions? You can ask questions in English or in German. So it doesn't really matter. We will translate it. His German is much better than he made us believe.
No, it is true. My German is non-existent.
Any questions?
Thank you very much, especially for this last very important remark, also in a political dimension. I think Portuguese, you may have already some experience, because Portuguese is a language that spreads far further on the globe, if you don't count only the journalists from Germany, but whole populations. So what are the experiences in editing for different cultural backgrounds? What aspects do you see there that we have to consider?
Yeah. Well, thank you for your question. As a practitioner, let's put it this way, of editorial scholarship and a maker of editions, I believe that the situation as far as Portuguese language is concerned is very different depending on the country you are referring to. So, in Portugal and Brazil, there is a situation with some common ground, but then a very important specificity. The common ground is that both in Portugal and in Brazil, because of a common literary heritage up to a certain point, you have a reasonably strong tradition of textual criticism in the traditional sense, that is. The very important difference is that where in Portugal you favor an idea of an inclusive textual scholarship encompassing both traditional textual criticism and genetic criticism, in Brazil there is a strong divide between genetic criticism and traditional textual criticism. There is a very powerful school of genetic criticism in Brazil, and people from the two sides of the divide try not to meet the other people. Okay, so to a certain extent, they represent a certain tendency of, how can I put this, of autonomous thinking, of critique génétique. As to the other countries, what is really regrettable is that neither in Portugal nor in Brazil there has been the idea of making a team similar to the one that works at ITEM, and so give the opportunity of editing and preserving some very important texts and documents from Mozambique, Angola, and so forth. When I tried to do something similar to this a few years ago, the reactions both at university level in Portugal, but somewhat also at universities in Angola and Mozambique, were not very welcoming. So it is culturally a very different situation. No tradition in some of these countries, a tradition in two other countries, and then a strategically and historically important difference when comparing Portugal and Brazil. I don't know if I answered your question, but okay, thank you.
Any more questions? I have a short question. You showed slides where you showed TextGrid and Dahlia.
Yeah.
Where the hell do you know TextGrid from? Dahlia, I can imagine, but TextGrid. And both of these have like digital preservation modules in it.
Mm-hmm.
And why do you stress the need for that so much if we have initiatives like that?
Hmm. Why do I stress the need for?
For digital preservation.
Yeah. Two things. The first, I believe the less important one, how come do I know TextGrid? You and I and Bodo Plachter and maybe other people in the room belong to international societies. We do read the articles we publish, and TextGrid is mentioned in more than one article, so there it goes. As to the most important remark you made in your question, as I tried to point out at the beginning of this paper, as we speak, things are happening, and we don't know the shape of those happenings and the consequences of what is happening today. It is a felicitous I can only be happy to acknowledge that in some of these platforms we have facilities that are specially addressing the need for preservation. Are we 100% sure that those tools and programs that have been designed to address this need are in a position to assure reliability, stability, and long life within 30 or 40 years. And one very bad example of this is some of the functionalities of TextGrid have migrated to Dahlia. Okay, so this is something that we can as a European, I'm proud of it. Okay, and I'm thankful. But does this prevent us from being vigilant and, to a certain extent, worried about what happens next? I am confident but vigilant, and that's the mixed and hybrid position I try to endorse here.
I'm almost ready to ask another question. Would you be happy if institutions like Wolfenbüttel, Marbach or Weimar would host digital editions like that, you know,
mm-hmm.
safekeep them?
Yes, well, then we have, if I gave the impression that I am 150% sure about 50% of the things I said, I want to remove that impression from you. Let's imagine that I am the world, okay? my inner tension is between a totally liberal approach and a very much regulated approach. So a simple answer would be yes, I would very much welcome that institutions such as the MVV consortium, if I may say so, would incorporate these programs and could play this role. But one of the questions is, where do we draw the line? What is to be welcomed as something that is to stay, and what can be discarded as something that is not important? What are the budget restraints, even in a country such as Germany, which is being seen as the driving force in the European scholarly digital editions and digital preservation. Going on this route, is it the function of MVV, among the functions of MVV, the preservation of texts that belong to a German national heritage? Or are we speaking here of major editorial ventures at a more international scale? What is the policy? So yes, but yes means we are starting to talk now. This is the end of nothing.
Yeah. These books are still here.
Yeah.
Are there any more questions? If not, it is very late, and I want to thank both of these speakers for their wonderful talks and for the lively discussion. And I believe we have more time to discuss these things when we go over to the Anne Bockert House and have some refreshments. Thank you very much.